History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you don't want to miss out on, stories that'll go untold unless we take a little time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm visiting with 98, soon to be 99-year-old Walter Glenn of Dinuba, California, but originally from a place called Gowan, Oklahoma. He's a veteran of the 32nd Infantry Division in World War II, and we're going to hear about that. But I want to hear about Gowan, Oklahoma. And how many brothers and sisters did you have growing up there?
5 sisters and 4 brothers. I got 3 sisters living. Thelma Roberts, she was 100 last October. I moved her 2 days ago. She's doing good at the rest home over there. August 14th, I'll be 99.
So of those 10 children, where did you fit in? Which one were you in the birth order?
That was Zinni, Jack, Thelma, and then Walter. They were 2 sets of twins. And the twins went to the Army, World War II in Germany, and they made it back home.
So you had a set of younger brothers who were twins who both were in the war, too.
Oscar and Lois. Lloyd and Lois, Melvin and Elvin. Melvin and Elvin, they went to Germany, and they were then at the airport, and one couldn't get back. They kicked him out. Then when the engineers, they that one picked the 5th engineers, they built the bridges on the far across Germany around there for that boat up, and they made it home, too, that damn cold. Cold, snow, and ice, about freezing to death. I burned it up on the Pacific. They're all gone now, except 2 younger sisters and 1 older. Next October, she goes, she'll be 101. I'm a tracing right after her. My grandpa Henson was 103. He was going pretty good right up the end there. His hair never did turn gray.
At 103, yeah. So out of those 10 children, how many of them served in World War II?
Had 2 brothers, served in World War II, and a lot of cousins. Had 3 cousins over there, and they both made it home, but some of us through the South Pacific there. Had Neil Glenn, my nephew. He's been about 28 years in the Marines. He made it home from there, and his son is still in the Marines. My dad, he was in the service, World War I, but the war ended before he had to go overseas. I didn't know him then.
Yeah, exactly. You weren't born yet. Well, help me understand. What was life like in the 1920s in Gowan, Oklahoma? What'd you have to do?
We formed back there in Oklahoma when I loaded up about 18 in the 20s when it come out dust bowls, that 7-year drought. Our state blowing Arkansas one night. Next week it blow back here and it blow to Texas back up. That dust was bad, so dry. You just get a crop about every 3 years. While my daddy died, my mother brought that 10 of us kids. We came to California, 1941. That's when I turned 21. The war broke out. That was June next year. I went in the service for that. Stayed in there until November 1945 before I get my discharge down here. Everybody say they're sticking in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had quite a deal through that war.
Yeah, a lot happened in between, but I want to ask you about that. You said your father died, so here's your mother with 10 children moving out to California. How did your father die?
They called it dropped his heart. And some of that water, big water blisters come out on him all around there, and they couldn't cure that. At the time, he's about 48 or 9. Something like that. Nowadays, later they said they find a cure for that, but it's too late. What am I going to do? Well, sure, we make another crop out there. What well, that's enough to get by on that. Raise all the garden stuff, beans, peas, and all that, potatoes. Put it, we can it. My mother tough it out. We sell cream, eggs, stuff in the town market up, different times, had extra beans, the markets take all that, and we lived out because we run a little dairy, about 20 cows, but then had to sell that cream and eggs to get the other stuff, and my mother found a way to make my do with all of us kids. 10 kids, And Mama get in that great big old 34 Ford, tied it on like the grapes around. It's come into California, Bakersfield, where we had some folks out there. I mean, how she did it, but she did. Came to California, worked in there, I worked in the packing shed, and I got to making boxes for the packing. When that war broke out, and later, come back home, finally get married here in Dianuba. I worked at Alta Meat Company, I worked for the city, worked for the Nodsville, anything new. I went to do body work, I learned to do the body spinning work. I retired from that, a lot of hard work, straightening frames. Swanson 44, the business retired in 84. They wouldn't let me quit till about 92, and that's what we did at my life. In 93, I had colon cancer, and I whipped that at my life. Otherwise, I had a good life. But two daughters here just left out, one daughter died. So anyway, these won't let me rest. That's the reason I still won't go. They come and get me gone. I'm going in my rep and everywhere. She say, everywhere. We have a ball. And I live for that. I love my family, my grandkids. Thank God for that. And the 32nd Red Army Division, that old Wisconsin National Guard, they the finest booger in the world.
You mentioned you're in Bakersfield when the war started. Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor? What you were doing or where you were when you got that news?
Working at the D. Georgia Ranch when that broke out, Pearl Harbor, when this boy going to work that morning, the news was everywhere. Had more than that, the bombing in Pearl Harbor had that. So I waited a little later about going out there. They had a bunch of Japanese working out there. Well, they didn't come in. How many people had their guns out there? They're going to kill them. Boy, they had a big meeting, and they're talking on this war deal that moved up. So we all come home and get it settled up around on that deal up.
So you're working at a ranch at the time, and they had Japanese Americans working there.
The Georgia Ranch in the package here. They're packing grapes, packing asparagus. Finally end up making the fruit boxes. Boy, I make about $5,000 in a day, and then go home. That's when I could make over $100 in 2 weeks. Boy, that was a lot of money them days when you worked 15 cents, 20 cents. When the war broke out, that finally went up field working like 45 cents. That was a big deal then.
So I understand correctly, some of your co-workers in that packing shed were Japanese Americans?
Yeah, they had a bunch of Japanese lived out there working there. Some had the grocery stores. There in town, we used to trade with some of them people. I seen them over at a lone pine. I went up, helped build a concentration camp. Out of lone pine, way out on the desert, a big apple orchard. We built these works up. I talked to some of them Japanese and the girls and all. I go in, well, they get out still, they just go to school and let's come back around. Come on over, have dinner with us. I told them I feel sorry. I don't want help. And Roosevelt had them all locked up there, you know. The first one that moved over to volunteer, well, they could pick the works, that's where they live. And most of them could have a big old apple tree in the yard. I pulled about two generators. I keep them filled up. I pull the generator up. They can make about four houses up running that. With that generator going, it moved the units down around there. And that concentration camp around Lone Pine.
That's called Manzanar, is that one. So you actually helped build that facility?
Yeah, that's what I did. From there, come back to Bakersfield up. Then I want to get to go in the Army.
Sorry if I'm repetitive here, but I just want to make sure I understand what you went through, because you're the only one who went through what you went through. But I'm interested in this December 7th. So here the news comes that America's been attacked by Imperial Japan, and you go out to your job, and the Japanese Americans who are usually there working with you aren't there, but people are talking about them?
The Japanese Americans, they was working with us out there. So they didn't come to work that next morning because they knew something bad. Had the big meeting, packing said, and we're talking, get people settled out. Said there's a lot of these Japanese, the farmers and everyone, they're just good people, you know. We're trying to settle down and get it straightened out. But then later, that President Roosevelt, when he come up preaching about that war, because we didn't have TV or nothing them days. But the radio, they had to cover everything. So you kept right up on it. But that, I sure didn't think it was going to last that long. I didn't have to go in for 6 months or a year. I'd head the household. But I thought I'd just get it over. That's when I joined up.
You had an exemption because you were the oldest male at home, and so you didn't have to go in. and you thought the war is actually going to be over before I have to go in? Is that what you're saying?
That's what it did.
Yeah.
I thought, I'll go help get that over with. Went up Camp Antioch, stayed there 2 or 3 weeks, got ready, got on that grade over here, going to the Golden Gate Bridge. We're coming down Sacramento River, come on to the Golden Gate, 3 days out there. It took 4 days to get back. The engine stuff blown up, hobbled back on that bridge. I go back about 3 weeks, Camp Stoneman up there, Antioch. They repaired that ship and come back on that the third time. Then we go south, 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 had a big sea battle. So they go from the more south to miss that. They had that one alone ship, about 5,500 people on there, soldiers, you know, 500 Australian soldiers that took training over here. So we went into Sydney Harbor, landed up. We come back out, let them off, come back around out. That boat had blown up. This had enough steam to get back in there to Sydney Harbor. They didn't know the Japanese sub gonna sink us out there. We finally got back in there. Got off, stayed up, catch a train up to Brisbane, go in that jungle, filled up the 32nd Infantry. We all got there. Everybody took a little train in there, go up Clownsville, then that off in the New Guinea. From then on, we stayed over through that. You get tired of eating this ratchet, eat that ratchet. Never done. They try to get you a hot meal. We'll come back down. Somebody come down deep, set down, guard that big gun, and lay your rifle across. But never die, see one of the old trap, great old big, come a running, trying to get close and blow up. By the time they pick your gun up, well, then lucky, he falls so many shoot. He's trying to get close enough with some dynamite to blow up the gun. We're sitting watching that while we're eating the dinner. It looked like never die, it's kind of like a Western, but they didn't come back alive to fight again.
What was the first indication you got, or what was the first moment where it sank in for you, the gravity of the situation, and how much was at stake for you personally? I mean, you're a 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid halfway around the world.
I turned 22 in the service, and I turned 23 in Australia, and 24 in New Guinea, and I turned 25 in Luzon in the Philippines. That was at that time. At August about the 14th, I think my conscience board signed a peace treaty. Out in Japan, there, they had dropped them 2 A-bombs. We were going about 70,000 Japanese there. They hadn't quite given up yet. But by the time McCarthy went in there, then we had what they were marching up, putting their guns out. We had to guard them. Had a big fence all around that. I don't know where they put that many thousand, but anyway.
So that was your 25th birthday present, was Japan surrendered.
Yeah, that was there. And anyway, after that, either fly home or come on the ship. I said, I'll not take a ship. I'm afraid that plane of fall. We're running into typhoon out there. That water, all that damn thing, almost sick. And some of that we should have flew over. Come back way up north, and it's colder than that. We're going to lay out on the deck, get the sun down. Boy, put all this cold up there, have to loosen on it. And back, how that ended up down to Long Beach. But we didn't. Boy, that ground, I get up, kissed that old dirty ground.
So you had the choice of flying home or taking a ship, and you didn't want to crash in a plane, so you took the ship and then regretted it.
Yeah, and finally, coming through, up, I catch a taxi out the edge of town there. I thought I'd hitchhike down there. Mom didn't have a phone there, and I knew it. So anyway, here come a soldier, had a little close by there, come back, picked me up, brought me down to Dynuma, and went to Fort Grant. I didn't know that's where my mother lived, that post office box. So I go down to PG&E, had that up, they told me where she lived, and I wrote it down on Whisker Way. So anyway, it come out. Here come my mother, one of my twin brothers. Well, they went in that few months after I did, and they got home a few months early from Germany, did it? So Melvin got picked. Here we come back out home.
So we can thank PG&E for telling you where to find your mother's home. She'd moved to Dinuba while you were off at war, and all you knew was her P.O. box. That is something. And I guess we knew you made it home since you're here with us as we approach your 99th birthday on August 14th. And we've heard about before and after your time with the 32nd Infantry Division, but I know there are a lot of experiences in between the leaving and returning that we're going to want to explore. Right now, let's catch our first break. But when we come back, I want you to share with our audience what creature it was in those South Pacific jungles that you figured out was not only your friend, but maybe even a lifesaver. Of all the veterans I've had the privilege of speaking to over the years, I've never had anyone tell me this, so I think our listeners are going to be pretty interested in that, too. Walter Glenn of Dinuba, California, is our guest today. He saw over 500 days of combat with the 32nd Infantry Division in World War II, fighting in New Guinea and the Philippines. You can find photos and video of some of the things he brought back from the war at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll explore some of those memories of his when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to visit today with a guy who just may have fixed your fender once upon a time. Walt Glenn spent decades doing body work for car dealers in California's San Joaquin Valley, most recently what is now Farney Ford in Selma. He raised three daughters, and now, if you add up this almost 99-year-old's grandkids, great-grandkids, and even great-great-grandkids, that number is up to 25 people who would have never been born if he hadn't survived more than 500 days of combat in the Pacific with the Red Arrow Division, the 32nd Infantry Division in World War II. He was in a machine gun squad encountering intense action on New Guinea and later on the island of Leyte in the Philippines before participating in one of the division's crowning achievements, securing the Villa Verde Trail on the island of Luzon.
I didn't know how bad it'd be when I put my joint to get over there. By the time I come home, I know what, but I used to just go to sleep. I slept with that gun on my dark head. Anything wiggled, I'd wake up. I could hear good at that time. Like over at New Guinea jungle, but you them crickets. The crickets with the ears and the eyes. When them crickets shut up, something was out there. It was right. We had like that barbed wire, all that. Some little tin cans, two or three empty shell cases. Anything wiggle that bar, they would rattle. Think of this. You throw a hand grenade at that bunch. That'd be the Japanese. You'd kill them out there and build up. But them crickets, we had to use it for your eyes and ears at night. I love crickets.
The crickets saved your life.
Yeah, they do. When they quit tripping, there's something, you use that right here. You make a different noise, and the cricket will hush. And through that hot jungle, I've got a lot of things from that, from them doggone hornets and wasps. But I stayed away from snakes, alligators, trying to stay away from them jumps. But anyway, you know that machine gun, every fifth round is a tracer. It just like turn the spotlight. You can see exactly where it went. And that's when up hand on them. You can see right where that's going, right through. And you just move it up because it's heavy, that move up. And that's where we had it over them. Their machine gun clips about 30. But we had these, and we get up 25 or 30 yards, crawl up there before daylight. And then so many of us had the parachutes to set up. You put that on the end of that gun in a blank, and you shoot it out over the depth, shoot up about 100 feet or so, It's come up light, it's broke down, it's light, it light up all of that out there. You see all this moving on out, shoot them out there cooking them. They didn't know what taking place. Then you have to run on, you go up there, so they didn't want to. Maybe you could go up 200-300 yards or a quarter of a mile, and then you got to dig in again. They didn't have time, they couldn't pick up the dead and burnt. We just took out all that lately. 15,000 come and landed, put all the big gun up here. There's a few was still down there trying to get off the ship. This Arctic shoot here, and the plane is streaming across that, and they be shooting in behind, and every one of them was struck just like pearl on that, but that was fun. Killed that much. We said, now we get a rest, because it's 47 days taken out on it. We'll rest. No, they came from this place in Luzon. Here we go. Boy, I tell you.
What kind of machine gun were you operating?
It was that 30 caliber. It's really all six. All them guns were all six. Had sniper rifle 308. They still use this 308, Army, Navy, and Marines.
Your machine gun, though, this 30 caliber machine gun, this is water-cooled or air-cooled?
It was that water-cooled. And some of them had some of these water-cooled, but the H Company, we had the heavy weapon, the 50 caliber, they wasn't water-cooled. But them and I, on that building where they trail, had a big half-a-track truck up there. It started to break daylight. I get on the back of that, when it poured in the building, in some of the 50s. I get up to the top of that canyon, let it freeze down that bump. I clear down that river. I just open that. I scrape that up and down there, empty it out through that, because it dropped a current water from the river to get back over that. You ever see it toward the end of the war. Had some of them caves, going up, 100 or so Japanese, and with so many in them caves, a plane full of a bunch of belly tanks and jelly bombs. They drop all out of that and burn that canyon. Burned about 1,800 degrees, paradise. Who wouldn't have come out of it but rummed them? Some of them got out alive. And then there's so many that all that rough country, you couldn't get it. You carry your own out, but the Japanese just left them, just rot up and bugs eat them. You never forget. Now, I used to, years ago, it hurts about, you couldn't talk about why they get halfway rummed them after so many years.
Most people listening, they've never handled a machine gun. They don't know how it works, especially not 75 years ago. So how many people did it take to operate one of those machine guns?
At nighttime, there'd be four of us sat on that at night. And keep going, make sure you stay awake. I remember sitting in the middle of that highway. A Jap freaking off through. He ripped it out, and he'd come out that road. At the first time, that gun snapped one time. All that boy. He'd run off down the side. We got a cracker phone. Tell him now that it's Jap coming down through. So that's on the building where it fell. It wasn't many trees. It's kind of like his foothills. They seen him coming. They don't know they get him up. Down there by that river, Lieutenant Clement. He said, Glenn, how many rounds takes to cut that tree down? Great big old tree. You can't see across this part of the river, see? I looked there. It's pretty close to 150, a little less. He said, cut it down. I put it right close to the bottom ground. I pulled it through about 8 shots. I just turned it a click. Click, 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 down that tree go.
So you cut down a tree with a machine gun.
Then you can see all the crossers. Well, the drop was probably had them on the other side. We was going down after them.
You were in a machine gun squad, and then eventually they moved you to the motor pool. Is that what you said?
Yeah, that. I went from that down to the motor pool. First time I hauled that bunch of dead, I was afraid to look at them. I hauled that dead down. I know that I knew them, some of them that. But I thought, has somebody got to haul that dead down? You know, you haul the wounded and load the dead, take it down the cemetery, then they load that whole truck through that book where they can take their dog tag up, put a cross on them, and they put one of the dog tag on there, they keep the other ones, and then they know who's buried, roll them in the blanket, you put them in the ground, later on, if they find another place, they got to take him up to a regular cemetery. Had put them in there. I did that on Luzon in the Philippines. That first time I had to haul some of the dead out. And then when I take a load of Philippine load up, get that truck load up, all you get in there, you take it up at about 20 miles or some of that back in there, cause food, guns, water, ammunition, out to the troops across the lines, way off in that book of that. Then I'd haul a load of dead back down there. At river dive that afternoon, and later on, well, some of them, they brought out a short truck up. River dive, I'd go back, load the Filipinos, and bring it back down there, because they would pay them a certain amount for that, doing that. They were all a bunch of nice people that were glad to see us, you know.
And you said the first time that you had to transport some of the casualties, some of the dead, you said you knew some of those soldiers?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. I know some many of them troops after that, being with them about almost 3 years, over 2 years. I was over there 32 months, yeah. I think 18 days. You get to know a lot of them soldiers there, you know. How many of us have not known many? How many in our company? Well, you know all of them, you know. In the H Company, I know all of them, you know. And that one that took training was in some of the other places around there. Cousin Robert Demet had the 128th Infantry. And then went to James Howe. He then F Company, Rifle Company, right next to me 2 months. I went to school with him in Oklahoma. I was going down to aid station. I seen this soldier walking down there. I looked. I noticed his walk. I stopped and looked. Well, it's about that time he had seen me. So how long had he been there? He'd been those 3 or 4 months. I didn't know, but I went to school with that Bowers, Oklahoma, you know. And later on up, he got shot across the back, 3 shots, almost his spine. He squatted down. He's on the patrol, you know, coming in there. He said he'd jump about 30 feet. But he landed up. Then I pulled him back from the hospital. I told the Colonel Boom, I look here. You look at this soldier back. He's thinking about combat. It ain't even well. You got to stay in that hole a lot. The rabbit brain had been up. And that boy didn't get infected and kill him. Boy, he picked a note, send him back down to the hospital for a few weeks till they get well and back. And he ended up making it home.
Well, I'm just wondering, when you're hauling a truck full of dead Americans, guys like you who've been killed in action, do you look at them and say, that could have been me?
Oh, yeah. We stand up and shoot right up in that hole. Guys, well, if it ain't your time, it won't go. It never died when you pin down. So I used to keep the machine, keep them pinned down. The Japanese, when they called it a bunch of machine gun net, they get close enough to throw a grenade and blow them up, and then you can move it up a little further to keep it over the head. That's read, and this a criminal few could handle that gun without letting it get loose and drop and kill some of your own troops. It has happened with some of the deals, you know.
Yeah.
But your friendly force, you're dead.
Well, and that's a point, too. I mean, if you're on that machine gun, you're the first guy the enemy wants to take out, right?
It's in the life of a machine gun with 7 minutes. A lot of 7 I went through. There were 7 of them didn't make it. Somebody got to die. After about the 2nd year in there, I bet you we killed probably 20, 30 to 1 at least. Just plain outgunned them. But at different times, we had run into a bunch of Japs. This about time I got so far inland, I had to stop, put a line, and then all of them get settled up before they could push on across that audit. And finally, it takes the airport. Next day, we pushed on the pass over there. You hear that Japanese shoot, that makes a different sound. Come to find out, we knew the Japanese had landed and took up. But don't talk, bro. She told me it's going to do that. We used to like to lift her. You go back to your sweetheart, you do that big enough, you just give up. No, there's no way we're going to give up.
What are some of the moments that you look back on and say, that was a close call for me?
Say, many different times. I've been right there, and that shot shoot right across my cot. Some felt hit that old cot I was in. But standing in the chow line, run behind a coconut tree, and shoot down across over the hill there. Pretty soon they get that machine gunner from a sniper, had a hole dug in the bottom of a tree, and down there, and shoot out down around there. They found that sniper, but get so close to this coconut tree, take 10 shots through that coconut tree. At one fall out hanging on the rope, trying to step up in there. But up on the hillside, but boy, a lot of hills up through that jungle, dig holes in the ground, but around close to the bottom of a tree there, see. And shoot from that hole. And if you that come right close, but help me that little machine gun, you know, there's 30 rounds seemed like about a foot away or something. That, boy, that sound bad. Boy, you'd die fast. Been scared a lot when moving up, but you can't always be in. Every time you got to get out, sleep out by the side of the dang hole, unless if they go to shooting border shells at night, and border shells falling around, then you get in that doggone hole, that shrapnel, like to get you there. Don't you get in that hole, top guarded artillery, shooting out over your head. If you had a little blanket, if you didn't hold on that, it blowed out away them cannons. After about 2 days, when it comes time to sleep, you can sleep on them and shoot. You will sleep, I bet. Didn't think you could. Mm-hmm. But you will be. After so much stood up, you'll fall asleep, no matter what. Oh, then we had little blocks of TNT, little blocks of TNT, about like a quarter pound of butter. When you throw that and that unwrapped, a little trigger come, and it hit the ground, that thing blowed up. I used to like that, boy. That good day's hanging on you and all that called pineapples. I shoot said the big belts of ammunition and everything. A clip of ammunition. I take a clip, hit it slide down in that old free rifle. But used to, Japanese, they kept that with the shots when you're out there pulling that trigger, see. You shoot two or three shots, had to have some more shell and they spill that back. When they figure the fifth round that, different time they raised up to shoot that, but you be ready to blow them down. Oh, you learn a lot of tricks if you live long enough.
Well, by that measure, you have quite a few tricks. And that reloading the rifle mid-clip to throw off the enemy's round count was just one of the tricks that kept you alive through 32 months overseas. Walter Glenn of Dinuba, California, our guest today. You can wish him a happy 99th birthday on August 14th. And you can find photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, we're going to find out what it was that landed him in the hospital and why that might not have been the worst thing for him. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to visit with a spirited 98-year-old who celebrates birthday number 99 on August 14th. For four straight Augusts during World War II, Walter Glenn marked birthdays in uniform, serving with the 32nd Infantry Division in the Pacific. He was a machine gunner and later a driver on muddy jungle roads in the Philippines. He had to deal with grenades, mortars, bombs, machine gun, and sniper fire. But it wasn't any of those things that landed him in the hospital. So why don't you tell us about that one thing out of more than 500 days of combat that did land you in the hospital. What was it?
I think of this, that foxhole, you put the dirt around, especially through New Guinea, later, at Leyte in the Philippines, after about 8 hours, it rains almost all the time, because there's so much shooting going on. I've been up, so the most time the daggone foxhole gets full of water. Think of this, I got some kind of daggone fever. I lined up, and they start put food in the plate. I just felt sick. Man, I felt I had a lot of fever. When I saw it, my son said, Glenn, you're on kitchen duty this weekend. I saw it. I'm sick. You've been in the hospital. I said, I don't have to be. I'm sick. I'm going back to the tent. I come back, told Sergeant Brooke, and I said, boy, I'm going to the egg station. Sergeant come down there, that's where Glenn at. Said he said he was sick. He'd been to the doctor. He said, if Glenn is sick, he is sick. So I went up that tent. I go on that rope. Said, you woke up here? Yeah, I got that. You feel all right? I feel hot. Just we got 103 fever. You got this fever. You got that? It feels like I'd like to take my bones out and sound them down. Boy, that is, but some stupid name of people they have over there. Then at that time, the division then went over to another campaign. So I had to help finish tearing the tent down. Then got my pack on. Just walk up in the combat. No more than I get up there with this shooting going on up. We got relieved of duty. I missed most of that campaign up. Thank you, Lord, for my birthday. Birthday 1944.
How long were you in the hospital?
I've had about 2 weeks or so, I guess, sir. I don't know what kind of medication, but that boy, he finally gets where you can have a little appetite again and eat. But that time, onion teeth, they got some of the funny, peculiar name of fever that them boogers had over there, you know.
But you would have spent those 2 weeks in combat if you weren't in the hospital, right?
Yep. I did that. I missed that while I was in the hospital.
So maybe that fever saved your life.
At different times, I've always got shot with some of my own troop. We were just training them to shoot. I thought they shoot right by me. I said, you got no sense. All that shoots the ground. You don't shoot where you can't see what's going on there. Felt like shooting. That boy, I that chewed that booger out. I heard you come out here. Have been training somebody, but I told you, you don't shoot through the brush. People, you're out here taking your training in this jungle, boy. I'll be doggone. But I've seen so many planes that fall hit in the daggone water and all them, and nobody get out of life and it burn them up, you know. And they've seen the ship hit right in the side. Japanese fly right in the side of one of them with a missile. I don't have many troops. It would die in some of the troop ship out there, you know. And we'd let it hit the ground, that big missile, hit the boat, that boat would come right up on our boat, and it hit and go down in the water, jumped our boat. Some way it hit and flew that.
So a missile hit the water in front of your boat and hopped over your boat?
So they didn't get no ship with that one. They seen him coming out, stream it. You squat down in that boat, it wouldn't do no good. Because it would shoot right through it, but if you could hide behind anything, it hadn't hit you. That was something again that a lot of what I think was close calls, as well as some of the time while you're sleeping, never know it about, you know. But I tell you, there's so many different places through there, you don't know how close it called on it. Where you drive a truck, right a landmine in the road, and different ones have to hit that. Sometimes it blow up a daggone wheel. With a tar, something off the truck, somebody killed a whole bunch in the daggone truck or something that hit that landmine in there. And out in the fields, what it put about there, that booby traps. It wasn't as many booby traps and landmines through the audit there. That's because there's too much rain on it. But like Hussein, look how they put all that junk in that over there. I could still never think about it, about thanking the good Lord how many different times. And I might have could have didn't die like somebody else, but this wasn't my time there. I don't know how many close calls, but it was a lot, there was plenty of them. I used to think, used to really hurt me, wake up, think about it. Always tears come my eyes, and got finally, after so many years, 60, 70 years, 70-some years, then you get rummed up. Kind of try to block out that part as much as you can. I just figured, so many friends you took your daggone training with and all that bugger that, and that's worse. You don't make it back. Thank the good Lord for sparing me this all this extra time.
Earlier you were talking about an incident that you were going to be given a medal for, but the person who was going to put you in got killed.
I'm supposed to get a medal for driving under that gun for him with him, that jeep, that mountain gun shooter, but Captain Watson's going to do that. And that was off that Middlebury Trail. Oh, that's probably back in about June 1945, I guess. But anyway, that mountain gun, if somebody got a hold of him, and wounded that bugger that, and tried to get that speed, he slowed up, go around the shoulder up, around the bomb hole, three or four up, finally get it, talk loving. As you come in the trees, it's a little old narrow spot. There's a bum laying in the road. You had to miss that. It might set it off. It was dead. You'd drive right by how fast you could. But it then behind the trees and that, and then out to the medics. Yeah, that's something about holding from my underbar or something. But I didn't get enough for that. Then another place, we got off in no man's land. There was three or four of us, Leroy Hines, Burgess Kennedy, had them up. But we got the wrong road down no man land. They're going to give us a president citation for that. That's the same thing that won the captain up. But some sergeant has gave us that little purple medal for that boat up. It was taken in the box out of stuff had it, but it wouldn't put on the books. I thought all that no man's land till we took it back. We're lucky that the Japanese had scattered back. They tried to get back closer together, because then time they got scattered off out, but the patrol that hit around them over there had killed that bunch over there, you know. After that A-bomb was dropped, the second one up, they dropped them some radio stuff and down in there. Why, they started coming out of there. Oh, yes, carried that stack of the rifles up there. All that outfit, building daggone fence all around there, place where they put tents and stuff, all that. Every corner, the place had a machine gun. The thing of this, they would introduce some new vehicles and stuff. We're going to have to go to Japan. I've been going to the 6th Army and land in the rice paddy. If they did what they did, then kicking up daisies, because you know it's so long it's going to be it. You just think, when they were dug in from the Philippines on, in the Jimmy, all these other islands, they seem they did like the Germans, all that solid rock out shooting that ocean. Well, it had bombed. I bet you we would have killed 7 or 8 million Japanese. We'd have lost another 600,000 men. Oh, my David, didn't you see them hate to drop that bomb? They didn't do nothing. I said, Drummond, what the truth did I do? Oh, he thought that was terrible. Well, it is. But the thing it is, I said, Moss, I'm glad it, but I'd been dead over there. We'd killed a lot more millions. And that's war. There's nothing good about it. But anyway, I can thank the good Lord for keeping my pretty good health through the years. That one day before we had such a battle on that Billy Birdie Trail, that was a hard battle up. About 3.5 days, that Jap was trying to take that hill back. And we run real short on ammunition for the Birdie Trail and that Colonel Bourne. He came up there, and that time had me halt some ammunition. He goes up to the front line. He crawled out looking down there at these Japanese. He called back down where all these mortar shells shooting in there. Said, Jonesy, any way you slow that down a little? Can you slow it down about half as many? He said, Nips don't have time to get up. I think we'll kill more. And sure enough, he did. Said, Nips, slow it down. They get up to run, some of them shells that got killed more. I went down to get another load of ammunition. Oh, Captain King down there said, you done shot your coat of ammunition. Well, I get on call. I called a second lieutenant in charge up there. Well, when he's in charge, he's got much in the general seat. Anyway, I told him, you might not shot our coat of ammunition. He said, Glenn, I need a lot of ammunition up. Let me talk to him. I had him that phone. Boy, you could, he looked me like he'd battered up. That boy, that's how low that left. Haul that back up there. Then he wanted me to take a water trailer back down. It's like 500 gallons. I backed up to get that back. A couple of soldiers come to hook out on there. They can't move it in that mud. They hollered for some help. When a sniper come up here, shoot spraying across, they grab that and drag down that mud, hook out on there. I took off around the bend. Time I got down the bend, had to stop there. I laughed hard. I couldn't drive. I pulled up. They dragged that trailer in that mud they had. Something doing this thing happened. That different thing in my life over through that. I live tell about that one up.
Tell me about the honor flight. When you went with other veterans to Washington, D.C., what was that like for you?
It was awesome. I said, we went on that honor flight. I looked at the unknown soldier. That get to you. But all that, it was awesome. That was some trip. I said, they came back over the mountain just before we get that mountain. Had mail called. I didn't know my grandson, all this. Well, they had all that mail rigged up to give it to me. All these other had mail from all that. They get that mail, they had it all the time, give it up. All the school children, it was son in law's class. Little letter about all that. Thank me for my service. I'll be done. I got all that paper from them kids, and it's awesome. That was something, again, I love that.
When you were at the World War II Memorial, and you see that wall of all the gold stars, over 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. What were you thinking about when you were at that spot?
Just looking, and you think, how many families up there? And this hurts. It sure does. And you look at all the crosses, at the ones that's buried in that, all the cemeteries, all over. You can't beat that. It's plain awesome how all that is kept in remembrance, you know. Yeah, I got to meet so many nice, doggone people and other soldiers and their friends that threw that tour that back up. I still run on to them at the grocery store around here, but I haven't run into nobody from the 32nd Infantry Division. I don't know how long it's been since I've seen one of them.
This isn't an easy question, but I want to ask it because I think it's important because, you know, most of us didn't live through World War II. We really don't know what it was like to do what you did. And we didn't lose friends in the war the way you did. Are there some guys who you served with who didn't come home, who you think about from time to time? Are there names that you remember or faces?
I do. Every so I get to thinking and wondering, so did miss them. Never one about their families. Think about that. Some close friend. It just so, feels so bad that hurts, especially when it. You work close together, they put their life on the line, you can sleep while they were watching over you. That makes it pretty close. That's what hurts. Yeah, this was so many good ones, like old Leonard, that truck driver, always happy go lucky. They just have to catch a bullet or two. That never goes away. And then go and help load in a bunch of dead. First load was another pretty bad. Let them unload it. Don't look at about that. Then you think, well, maybe I should have looked. Maybe.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess I'm most proud of winning the war and get to come back. All the troops about that were just relieved. How happy, how the eyes brightened up when you seen the war's ended. All that light that lit up our boy. What a wonderful feeling, having all that in the suburbs, as well as so many mothers and fathers, and lucky for some of the folks to come home. That's got to be about as good a feeling you ever find. It sure is.
Walter Glenn, 98 years old. Maybe you'll have a chance to wish him a happy 99th birthday on August 14th. One person who certainly will is his daughter, Linda James. And I thought you might enjoy hearing Linda's perspective before we wrap up today. When you were growing up, did you have any awareness of your dad's service in World War II?
No, not at all. That was not even talked about. So I don't even think I knew he was in the war, to be honest.
When was that first something you became aware of?
That's a loaded question because I was quite old because my dad never talked about it. Well, I knew he was in the service earlier than 10 years ago, but maybe 10 years ago it was pretty prominent that we talked about it. But only the last 4 years maybe that he really talks about it. Because before I would say something to him like, so I hear you're a war hero, and he would tear up and he'd say, I'm not the hero. But now he, as you interviewed him, you can tell that he can talk about it more now. There's some things that he gets emotional about at times, but for the most part, he can talk about it now. And so I've learned more about him in the last probably 2 or 3 years than I ever have as far as the war goes.
What do you think changed to make him open up about it more?
Just time and probably just talking to others. And maybe the biggest thing that changed it is when we went on the honor flight. I really think that did it because it was in 2015 that we went and he got to see others, the other veterans, and conversing with them, and they would all sit around and talk and stuff. And I think that really kind of like broke the ice, so to speak. I think that might have been it.
And that was a multi-generational family experience for you guys?
It was. My daughter, her husband, and my grandson from Colorado flew into Washington the same days that we were going to be there on the honor flight. I went as a guardian with my dad. They would walk to each destination we were going to and meet us there and walk around through it. It was fabulous. It made the trip even better because we shared it with the family.
Were you surprised at all by any of the things that happened on that trip or how your dad was treated on that trip?
I wasn't surprised because I knew veterans are just precious cargo, so to speak. And I wasn't surprised by any emotional things that went on. I was really waiting for the mail call to come because he completely did not know that. I mean, that was the big secret. So I knew all those letters that he was receiving from my brother-in-law's school kids and letters from all of us that we compiled. I knew that was coming, but of course none of the veterans did. And that was probably the neatest thing out of the entire trip, is to watch that.
As you've learned more about his time in the military, the places he was, some of the things that happened, is there a story or two that really grabbed you or really got to you in thinking about being in his shoes in that situation?
When he talks about, because he was a gunner, he's shooting at people, right? But for him to be that and knowing that bullets are whizzing past his head, that's real scary. And he couldn't stop. He had to continue because that was his job. And that his integrity is that he does whatever he's supposed to do, you know, and without fault, he's going to go through it. And so knowing that he had to stand behind the machine gun and operate it with bullets coming his way as well, he couldn't duck and hide. So yeah, that's huge.
And there's a lot of people who wouldn't be here if one of those bullets got them.
Absolutely. Me, one of them.
I know that sounds cliche, but I think a lot of us go through our daily life not thinking about that.
Yeah.
How real of an awareness is that for you? Because it's not just you. You had a couple sisters, and there's grandkids and great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids.
Yeah.
How real is that idea?
It's hard to wrap your head around that. It really is. I mean, it's real, but I don't know how to even say how real it is. I mean, it is a fact that many of us would not be here.
And he's just your typical 98-year-old, right?
Not even. Oh my gosh. This man is so active. It's unbelievable. He says that us girls take him places and keep him active. He stays active all on himself. He's going to be driving until he's 100 years old, which is next year. When he took his driver's license, he got 100% on it. Shocked us, because we don't even do that. He's very active. He never meets a stranger. He loves everybody. He loves life. And he's always on the go. He's always up for anything. He's the best travel buddy you could ever want. So, yeah, I keep him hopping, but he keeps himself hopping too.
Why do you think it's important that people your age, my age, younger than us, know what your dad and all those guys like him in World War II, a couple of your uncles also, they went through all those years ago?
Oh my God, it matters today because that's what we have today. We have our freedom because of that. That's it in a nutshell, bottom line. So they need to know that. And you know, a lot of the younger kids do realize that. It surprises me sometimes. Some of the younger kids, whenever my dad and I have gone on trips, they will come up and they will, if we're in restaurants, and they'll pay for his dinner, our dinner. We've had that happen numerous times. They will get ready to pay our ticket and they'll say, oh, it's already been taken care of, either by another veteran or by a young couple. And it's just astounding. So a lot of them do know.
Anything else you want to say about your dad?
Love him, love him, love him. Yeah. You're going to get me choked up here, Paul. Don't do this. I do. I love him to the moon and back. He's awesome.
There's a little more from Linda and, of course, her dad in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. But here on the radio, we're out of time. So thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.